This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, former Kellogg executive George Franklin tells us about the policy and political implications of labeling foods for GMOs. But first, reducing poverty is a long-term proposition. That idea is most often conveyed as years of policies designed to change the conditions that lead to and keep people in poverty. But Goodwill Industries of Southwest Michigan is taking a long-term approach to fighting poverty with individual families. Here to discuss the Life Guides program is Goodwill Industries CEO John Dilworth and Jennifer Fletcher, who's a life guide for families that are hoping to get out of poverty. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Explain how Life Guides works.
Well, Life Guides is a 20-year commitment to families who want to exit poverty that have a child 0 to 3. And the idea is that child 0 to 3 is the focus of the program, and when we're all said and done, we want that person, when they're 20 years old, 21 years old, 22 years old, to have a post-secondary degree and a living wage job. The reality of programming that is federally and state funded is 90 days to change a person's life. We spend tremendous millions, billions of dollars on 90-day programs, which make no impact at all. And if you keep doing the same thing, you're going to get the same result. So back in 2010, we looked at what we were doing and said, there's got to be a better way. What is the way to make this happen? Harlem Children's Zone came to town. Kalamazoo Community Foundation sponsored the visit. Some community people went to the Harlem Children's Zone. And we looked at it and said, this is a nice model, but we're not Harlem. So how do we make it work here? So what's different about what we do here is we didn't take an apartment complex in one neighborhood. We asked communities, folks, nonprofits, schools like Kalamazoo Public Schools, Head Start, to nominate families that they believed were ready to make a change. And so we interviewed those families and signed them up. And we started with 20 in Kalamazoo County 4 years ago and 10 in Allegan County. And those communities were chosen because while we supply half the revenue from our store sales, if you ever wondered where all that money goes, this is where it goes in Kalamazoo County and Allegan County. It's to Life Guides and other programming. But Life Guides is one of those things where we could start it with our own money, but we want the community to match it. You know, we don't want to do anything by ourselves. Everything's about collaboration and partnerships. And this particular program is, I think we have over 50 different partners around the community that are working with it. So the community got on board, the Gilmore Foundation, the Kalamazoo Community Foundation, and we started it up. And Jennifer was brought in about a year after we started it, and she can probably talk more about specific outcomes that we've had. But what's been really interesting is while we focus on that child 0 to 3, we don't have too much data on that yet because they're just starting kindergarten. The siblings are doing exceptionally well.
You're talking older siblings?
Older siblings. Mm-hmm. They're reading at, you know, 70% are at reading level. Well, that's a middle-class family. That's not a poverty family. In Allegan County, it's 90% of the children that are part of the program are reading at grade level.
Right. So what we thought was our target audience was going to be the young child. We really have taken a more dual-generation approach and focused on building the strengths of the parents and the families, so that we're seeing results, unanticipated results, but exciting results.
I want to go back to just a moment for what you mentioned about choosing the families. Kind of take us through that screening process. How do you decide that, you know, this particular set of families are going to be the ones that are, you're going to help?
So at Goodwill Industries, our mission is to help families become sustainable, individuals and families become self-sustainable. We know that that at Goodwill means education and employment. So when we meet with families who are interested in the Life Guides program, I'm able to bring them into Goodwill, and we do an interview process where they can ask questions about the program, what's going to be expected of them, because we have a monthly meeting that they attend each month, and then they also have to meet with their coach once a month. those are really the expectations. We don't have a lot of hoops for people to jump through, but they do have to be focused on education, employment, and wanting to exit poverty. That does have to be their goal.
The other thing that's unique about this focus that we have is that we recognize that every person is a unique individual. It is not a one-size-fits-all deal at all. It is very much specifically tied to the individual family makes their own goals that are different, family X versus family Y, different goals, looking for the same overall outcome when it's all said and done. But that doesn't – everyone's got a different way they're going to get there, and everyone's at a different level when they come in. And one of the other things that's happening is the, some of the families that are farther ahead and end up mentoring the folks that are not as far along. Mm-hmm. So it's as time goes on, Jennifer has a little less to do.
It's incredible to see the families at the monthly meetings. And a lot of my families say, well, you know, we're busy and it's cold. We didn't really want to come out. But the kids know when the meeting is. The kids ask the parents, when's the meeting? When's the meeting? Because the kids have such a good time. So the parents have now really formed these bonds together where at first they might have been a little bit more reticent or not known what they were getting into. And now they're making friends and mentoring one another.
They're forming their own neighborhood. And one of the biggest obstacles in poverty is you don't know your neighbor. You don't have someone to call when your car breaks down or when you need to go to the doctor or you have an emergency with a child or something. So these folks are all in it together and they've formed their own neighborhood. And that's something a middle-class family kind of takes for granted. And so that's another core
element
that was probably unanticipated, mm-hmm. but really is making a difference.
Let's talk about that a little bit more, though, the things that a middle-class person sort of just accepts as part of the background noise of their life that someone in poverty is struggling to find. What are some of those things?
I would say that being in poverty is quite possibly the most time-consuming experience. We have a great bus system in Kalamazoo. I have a lot of families that depend on it, use it, and you have to wake up an hour and a half just to catch the bus so that you can get to where you need to go. In middle class, we're used to waking up, jumping in the car, and getting to where we need to go. So there's a lot more time spent getting resources.
And depending where you're going, you might have to transfer. I remember talking to someone who it took them, you know, an hour and a half or mm-hmm. something to get between two spots that seemed relatively close together to someone who has a car.
Absolutely.
So why a full 20 years? Why does it take this long to truly move a family who's currently in poverty out?
Well, five have already moved out of poverty.
Were they early then?
They're early, but the other part is making sure they stay out of poverty, okay? People move in and out of poverty depending on life situations and stuff. So that's part of it is bringing some consistency over the long term. So that it becomes the way you approach life. And so for families that have exited poverty, we become more grandma or aunt kind of thing. We provide the safety net, if you will, so that they know that, hey, someone's there for me. And I think that in a middle class environment, we take that for granted, okay? I was thinking about my daughter and, you know, she graduated from college at Grand Valley and going for a master's and stuff and car breaks down and dad picks up the tab, right? Well, if you're just day to day, well, you don't have someone to pick up the tab like that. So maybe Goodwill picks up part of that tab. We always do things. We never pick up the entire tab. It's always a partnership kind of thing. You know, you put in 100, we'll put in 100 so that it's a
partnership.
Partnership.
Absolutely.
Collaboration.
Mm-hmm. So we're really trying to help people problem solve and feel empowered and not feel like they were just
a hand up, not a handout.
Mm-hmm.
And is that how you think you're going to be able to move people from poverty to true self-sufficiency? Is that there is some partnership there, that there is maybe a little skin in the game on the part of the person who needs that
car
repair?
There has to be skin in the game. And that's actually from a community point of view, and that's kind of why we're doing it in Kalamazoo and Allegan counties is because the community said, we're going to put skin in the game. We could do that. We have six counties. We're Kalamazoo, St. Joe, Barry and Cass, Van Buren, and Allegan. We could be doing this everywhere, but not every community says we want to put skin in the game. So we're doing it where people want it.
Do you hope to be able to expand eventually into other counties?
Love to.
What do you need to see?
We need to see the community step up financially and with partnerships to do the same kinds of things that we're able to do in Kalamazoo and Allegan counties. Businesses, foundations, schools, just everyone working towards a common goal, common purpose. And, you know, Kalamazoo is a unique community in that regard. There's just a lot of resources here. And also a willingness to think outside the box on the part of some of the folks that have the financial resources in the community, both private and with the foundations. And, you know, the United Way just recently talked about the long-term focus, you know, deeper instead of so wide. Well, exactly. That's the way you're going to make a change.
Right. And maybe, John, you want to talk about the cost, because in Kalamazoo, we have 30 families that we're serving now. And that's 41 adults and 86 kids. So we have monthly meetings where we provide a meal, and sometimes we bring in speakers. We do some different education pieces. Sometimes we just let people kind of talk and share what they're going through. We call it joys and concerns. But
well, the cost is $6,500 per year per family. And that may sound like a lot of money, but that's what the Department of Human Services spends every 90 days on a family in poverty. So we do it for a year. They do it for 90 days. Not that we want to do or any way, shape, fashion, form, duplicate what they do. They provide a valuable service. But there's different ways to get a return on your investment. We think this is a great way to do that.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about balancing short and long-term goals. I mean, we know the long-term goal is that people are going to exit poverty at some point. So what do you focus on short-term? What are the steps to get there?
Well, I think an example is the other day I had a client call me on Friday morning, and she said, I think I'm going to have to quit my job. And I said, whoa, what's going on? She said, well, my daycare just fell through, and I don't think I can get a ride anymore to work, so I'm just going to have to quit. So I said, well, let's take a deep breath. Let's do some problem solving. Let's pinpoint, you know, what are some other things you could do? What are your thoughts? So after she talked it out and we processed it, she came up with alternative plans. And so I think, you know, hung up the phone, we both felt a lot better about the situation. But I think that that's that piece of the long-term goal, is that people really have to have that practice of problem solving and having a good sounding board of someone they can trust, and then they can hear their own ideas in a way that's supportive and moves them forward to what their goals are. That's something that we're really trying to build, and that takes time. It takes practice, especially if you haven't grown up in an environment that was conducive to a lot of problem solving and processing and being solution focused and goal oriented. So.
And from the child's perspective, we want the child to be kindergarten ready. We want them to be reading at grade level in the third grade. We want them ready for middle school, for high school. We want them college ready. Those are all the basic goals, and those are the same goals we have for every child in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just having the resources to make sure that they have the same opportunities that every child has in the community.
I would say that each of our families had a lot of they were socially isolated and they weren't real involved in the community. And since becoming engaged with Life Guides, their children have had opportunities to go to Pretty Lake Vacation Camp, but maybe the, you know, parents were afraid, they didn't know where it was or what went on there. Kalamazoo Nature Center has provided camperships for our kids. We have them more engaged with the Kalamazoo Public Library program. So
YMCA.
Really, the YMCA. I have some families now who have family memberships to the YMCA.
So the key thing there, is, if you're thinking about it, is, well, that's what everyone does. But not everyone does that.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So we've got to put those opportunities in front of them and make them feel comfortable that, yeah, you can do this.
Yeah. And build their confidence.
Jennifer, you mentioned earlier that there are not a whole lot of hoops for people to jump through, but there are some requirements. And is there a point where a family, if they're not meeting them, may be told that they're no longer part of the program?
I would say we've had three families that have exited LifeGuides, and we had to sit down and have a heart-to-heart talk about what their goals were. There were some people that just really weren't ready to make changes necessary, and employment wasn't a priority, education wasn't a priority. So we had to have an honest conversation about that.
So you mentioned that you're seeing some positive results so far. Can you tell us if there are, you mentioned that we've had some families leave poverty. We've seen some improvement with the siblings in terms of how they're doing in school. Anything else right now that tells you that this is going in the right direction?
I would say even just small things, like Goodwill always has a float at the holiday parade in downtown Kalamazoo, and we have LifeGuide families that show up and help us pass out books as part of the float. I have families that are participating in Lift Up Through Literacy on their own. I have families that have sought out family counseling on their own. I feel like there's a lot of little things that happen along the way that sometimes we don't have a way of quantifying or measuring.
It's about a change of mindset, and that's a gradual process. Now that we've got 4 years into it with, most of the families, we're seeing that mindset change and some of the things that were really troublesome back in the beginning really aren't issues with that particular group. As we bring in new families, we get to revisit some of that again. But the other part of that is that the families coming in are mentored by the families that have already been there. And that's the other part that we now have going on is, hey, I was in your shoes, and this is what I did to get out of those shoes.
John Dilworth is the CEO of Goodwill Industries of Southwest Michigan. Jennifer Fletcher is a LifeGuide for Goodwill's long-term program, which is designed to help families get out of poverty. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A new law is set to go into effect in Vermont this summer that requires the labeling of all genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. It's the first state in the country to do so. That change is likely to have effects nationwide. George Franklin is the president and founder of Franklin Public Affairs. Before that, he spent 30 years with Kellogg. And Franklin is also a former Western Michigan University trustee and the author of Cereal Wars, 30 Years of Lobbying for the Most Famous Tiger in the World. George Franklin, welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Gordon, thank you for having me. And I'd like to begin by emphasizing to your listeners, I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm not lobbying on either side. I'm not actively involved. But given my background and interest in government affairs, I'm hopefully attuned to it and have been following this issue closely for a couple years now, really.
Okay, so you've been following it closely. What can you tell us about why it is that one law in a state, and admittedly a pretty small state, Vermont, might mean changes nationwide?
Well, it's actually interesting, and I call it a combustible confluence of substance, process, and politics. And by the substance, as you mentioned, on July the 1st, a few weeks from now, a Vermont law requiring GMO labeling goes into effect, which could determine how 60 to 70% of the products in a grocery store are labeled around the country. The process part of it is you have a state with 600,000 people. Michigan has 10 million, to give you a reference point, which as a practical matter is going to determine the national food labeling policy, even in states that have already rejected GMO labeling. There's four states. It's Colorado, Oregon, California, and one other, Washington, that have in some form or fashion have already rejected GMO labeling.
This is where it was on the ballot and
the
voters
ballot,
rejected
right.
it.
That's 55 million people in those four states. But as a practical matter, because of the complexity of our food chain, our food supply system, the 600,000 people in Vermont are going to determine this national policy. So that's the process part. And then the politics of it are fascinating. If this political year isn't crazy enough, this is the world upside down. You have most people regard Republicans as conservatives, which connotes states' rights, that they should be in favor of states' rights. Most people think of Democrats as liberals, which implies more federal authority and less states' rights. The exact opposite is true on this issue. The Republicans favor federal preemption. And in fact, just a couple weeks ago, the House passed, basically on party line votes, the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act. The vote was 275 to 150, basically along party lines. There were 45 Democrats, I think, that went over to the other side. But this act would preempt Vermont.
So and any other state that wants to pass
state.
Anything
yeah,
like
it. It makes it voluntary is what it boils down to. When you cut through it all, it would make GMO labeling voluntary.
For companies.
For companies. So politically, the Republicans are the liberals and the Democrats are the conservatives. So once again, upside down, topsy-turvy political year.
Is it the fact that the Vermont law would have nationwide effects, is that because companies don't want to spend the time and effort to label things differently that are going to Vermont as opposed to things which are going to Michigan, Ohio, et cetera?
It is so much more complex than just the label. And the issue gets to be in sourcing ingredients. Where do you source the ingredients? Are they GMO or non-GMO? The supply chain, the distribution. The other thing is big food companies and little food companies that provide product to national chains. The national chains aren't going to want to have to differentiate between what goes to Vermont and what doesn't go to Vermont. And they're going to pass it back to the food companies and say, that's your problem. You give us product that we can put into our supply chain that we can service all our stores around the country. So one Senate aide actually told me one time, they said, well, you know, why don't you just not sell to Vermont? There's only 600,000 people. That leaves you 300-some million more out there. And once again, it's just not that simple. It's a much more complex food system than that and a distribution system that just doesn't allow that to be as cavalier on Vermont as people might think.
Somebody in the side which is supporting this measure in Vermont or have supported one of the other ballot measures that went on the states and, you know, on the ballot in California, et cetera, may say, look, all we're asking here is to know that GMOs are in there. What's wrong with simply knowing? We're not telling them they can't put them in. We're not telling them they got to alter anything in there.
Right.
We're just saying to the company, if you put GMOs in the food, we want to know what's there. And what might be the answer to that?
The answer would be that it becomes misleading. It's implying there's something about GMO ingredients that is materially different than non-GMO ingredients, which the vast majority of scientists do not agree with. The Food and Drug Administration does not agree with. And the food manufacturers are concerned that they're going to be seen as creating the word people use is Frankenfood, right? There's something wrong with it. Why is it labeled? Why is genetic engineering on this label? Why is that being brought to my attention? Well, it implies there's something different about it. And the reality is, according to most scientists, now obviously there's some scientists who would disagree, that GMO corn is not materially different than non-GMO corn. And to lead people to believe otherwise is misleading.
So if this law does go ahead and go into effect, what is that going to mean for companies? Do they at some point say it is going to actually change the food that we eat, or is it just simply a matter of changing the labels?
Well, some big companies already announced they're going to start labeling and have just sort of bite the bullet and we're going to do it. What it then forces them to do, and especially us being in Michigan, is the sugar beet boys are going to get hit pretty hard. Because they don't have the luxury of being able to quickly go non-GMO. And there's already a lot of companies that are talking about we're going to have to switch to cane because we can get cane non-GMO as opposed to beet. The prominent corn, soybeans, sugar beets, potatoes are sort of the big products that are GMO. So the suppliers of those products are going to get hit. Because the companies are going to have to go elsewhere, and the companies are going to probably have to pay some more because those other suppliers, those alternative suppliers, they got some leverage. It's supply and demand.
Have the states moved in here in part because the Food and Drug Administration has, to this point, only offered guidance on the labeling of genetically modified foods. I mean, is there something of a vacuum there?
Yeah.
Because there are not especially solid federal regulations.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that the FDA, once again, doesn't see a material difference in any reason to highlight GMO versus non-GMO. That's why they haven't acted. In fairness to the consumer groups, back to what you said, they saw an opportunity in Vermont. They believe there's just a fundamental right to know. They believe there is an inherent problem with having ingredients that are genetically modified, and they want to bring people's attention to it. So the lack of action by the FDA does create an opening, but the reason they didn't act was they saw no need to. So that hence created an opportunity in Vermont.
You have not been working for Kellogg for a while now, so
right.
You're not necessarily in the nitty-gritty here of what's happening, but you're someone who has watched legislation go through all of the tributaries and
the sausage
being made. You've seen plenty of it being made,
and
I'm sure you could tell us why we don't want to watch it being made. So if you had,
that needs to be labeled.
There we go.
That process.
There we
labeled.
Go. So, but if you had to make your best guess as we sit here and talk in May about what's going to happen before July 1st, when this law is supposed to go into effect in Vermont, what do you think is going to happen?
I think a deal will be reached at the federal level. And I think a couple reasons. One, the practicalities of it. You have Senator Pat Roberts, who's the chair of the committee, and our own Senator Debbie Stabenow, who's the ranking Democrat, right now in negotiations and offers are going back and forth. Senator Stabenow was able to get a bipartisan farm bill through the last Congress, which was a major piece of legislation and practically the only major piece that got through, much less bipartisan. And she's a skilled legislator. So is the chairman. And the practical implications of this are significant. I mentioned that there are other states have already rejected GMO labeling. But the other problem is down the road, if some state decides to tweak Vermont, they say, well, we kind of like the way Vermont did it, but we really want to do it this way. So Rhode Island or North Dakota or whatever, they go off on their own path. Well, once you go down this road, you're going to have this patchwork of labeling and regulations and requirements that are just going to be insurmountable for food companies. And I think the legislators at the federal level, I think that's why the Republicans, you know, you talk about them not being for states' rights in this issue. It's the practical reality of what we have here. We have the greatest food system in the world. And part of it is because we do have a uniform system. We do have a national system. And once you start going down this road, you got problems. And I think between the skill of the two principals in the Senate and the practical realities of where this can go, I think the Congress will finally, hopefully, get something done.
And there's some sort of a compromise that you see here where there would be some sort of an olive branch for the people who want labeling for GMOs.
Yeah, yeah. And there's what people are talking about, smart labels, where you could use your phone and look on the code, and then it goes to a site that tells you all these different things you need to know. That's just one example. But yeah, there's offers flying back and forth, and there'll be the normal give and take. That's what it's all about. If I could digress again for a second, these politicians that go to Washington, guns blazing, my way or the highway. Well, there's 535 people from all sorts of walks of life that are gathered there together, many of which have nothing in common at all. And you have to compromise.
George Franklin, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
George Franklin is a former Kellogg executive. He's also the author of Cereal Wars, 30 Years of Lobbying for the Most Famous Tiger in the World, and he's now the president and founder of Franklin Public Affairs. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.